Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. Let me just comment very briefly my sincere apologies to listeners who tuned in on Saturday. We seem to have some power problems. I'm not a technical person, so I can't explain what went wrong, but we simply had a disconnect in terms of being able to connect with me on air and with my guest. And again, I guess when technical glitches happen, it's beyond the control of mere mortals like me, certainly when it comes to technical issues. And I ended up losing my program, getting cut off a couple of times in mid-sentence. So I do apologize for that. Hopefully, the gremlins that showed up on Saturday are watching football on Sunday, and they'll leave me alone. That would be very nice. My guest today is Robert Avely. It's great to have Bob back. Bob is a professor of philosophy at the Apple Valley College in California. His books include Democracy Now!, Anatomy of a Deception. We've discussed that book on the program before and many other topics. And again, it's always great to have Bob back on. Bob, welcome. So far, so good.
An undisclosed amount of radioactive water into the ocean because they were afraid of Typhoon Manyi about 3 weeks back. So at least 4 tons went into the ocean just from the heavy rainstorm that they were anticipating that was going to come. So, and it's very high levels of radiation. That somebody could die from this radiation exposure just at 4 hours worth of exposure to it. So it's very potent that they're dumping into the ocean and into their own groundwater, too, their own drinking water. And now the latest news, and this is why I said maybe you should hire TEPCO to take care of your power problems, TEPCO is trying to reactivate the largest nuclear power plant, which is the Kashiwazaki Kariwa facility. It's about 200, 300 miles from Tokyo. So they're certainly taking care of things.
It really is a disaster, Bob. We segued from New York power problems to Japanese power problems, but there is no question. Oh, for a good bit of time after the Fukushima meltdown, I wrote many articles about it, and I wrote several follow-up articles. The latest one I wrote was maybe a month, 6 weeks ago. And there's no question in my mind from everything I learned, and I'm certainly no nuclear expert, that the Japanese disaster is by far, by multiples, it's multiples greater than the next most serious environmental disaster in history. It is literally so serious that maybe half the planet will end up being contaminated. I have a friend who knows a lot about nuclear power, Bob. It's been a while since she and I discussed this. But she told me, among other things, when you go outside in Chicago, if it's raining, well, best if it's raining, don't go outside. But if you do, absolutely bring an umbrella, even if it's a light drizzle, because nuclear radiation is coming down on you, and you're tracking, it's falling on the ground, of course. It's in the drinking water, so you're going to drink it. And if it's on the ground, especially if the ground is wet, you're going to trek it into your home when you enter it. And she was that serious. And a good part of North America, I think the only safer areas is the Southern Hemisphere. But the Northern Hemisphere, North America, Europe, really devastating stuff, Bob. It really is incredible. And most of it has been covered up, but they can't cover all of it up. But again, the disaster is absolutely beyond the pale.
The thing that concerns me about this is not just what's in the air, because if you take just in Tokyo, for example, if you take the air measurement of radiation, it usually is about 0.05 of microsieverts, which is higher than normal, but I suppose you can live with it. But here's the thing that the media is beginning to report. If you measure the radiation near the place where the fresh fish is located in Tokyo, it's 2 to 3 times greater than the legal limit. And so what they're tracing it out to be is that food and fish from near Fukushima are sent to another prefecture. It's rebranded and it's reclassified and then sent on to another prefecture, and then that gets relabeled again and then shipped out. So the food and vegetables that people are getting, even if you think that they're not from Fukushima, if they're from Japan, they could well be from Fukushima. So there's no control of this. And then what they're doing around Fukushima is they're scraping off the top layer of the soil because it's so irradiated, and and they're putting it in regular garbage bags and just stacking them up. Well, when those start springing holes in them, then you're going to have another serious problem on your hands. But the food and vegetable issue now is a big issue that nobody seems to be reporting on. But if you eat anything from Japan, it could be coming from Fukushima.
I think if anybody eats any food imported from Japan, they're out of their minds, Bob. I mean, the stuff is absolutely contaminated. I believe the man's the nuclear expert who I want to just mention, Chris Busby, I think is the man's name, and I remember him saying something in the weeks following the disaster, that somewhere on the order of one-third of Japan was so contaminated with nuclear radiation that the entire portion of the country should be evacuated. And I think he implied by his statement that you cannot remediate this stuff over the short term, and the short term would be years and years and years, because this stuff can stay around forever and forever and forever. But again, I remember his shocking statement, and I believe his name is Chris Busby, and he is a world expert on nuclear radiation, literally saying that I think the northern third of Japan was so contaminated with nuclear radiation that everybody living there should be evacuated, the entire area should be evacuated, which really, he was saying, nothing should ever go on in this part of the country again. Just cut it off. Chuck it into the Pacific Ocean. It's worthless territory. And certainly if I lived there, I'd have gotten the hell out of there as fast as I could. But if I was in Japan, I think I would move out entirely. But, of course, the region is harmed. And then if this stuff crosses the Pacific in the air, in the water, America is contaminated. My friend explained that to me. Good parts of Europe are contaminated. This is serious stuff, Bob, and of course it doesn't show up until years later. It shows up in serious illnesses like cancer. But, you know, you don't have a nuclear disaster and cancer showing up the next day. It takes years, and they can never trace it back to a specific event. But there'll be who knows how many cancers alone that will result from what happened at Fukushima, plus all the other nuclear disasters that we never hear about, small stuff. We know about Chernobyl, which was terrible. And, oh, I forget the numbers, maybe estimates that real estimates may have been that maybe a million people died from it. But that was all covered up, and Fukushima was covered up. And again, we're talking about by far the greatest human environmental disaster in history.
And it could get worse, because in the news this week, it wasn't just Fukushima and radiation. It was the fact that John Kerry with Chuck Hagel were meeting with Japanese officials there, and they agreed to a lot of different things. But one of the things that makes the segue into the U.S. and Japan and the military thing that we're about to talk about is that they agreed to station an X-band early warning radar system in Kyoto. That is used for nuclear war. So that's the only thing that I know that it does. It tracks nuclear incoming missiles. If that's supposed to be directed at Russia or North Korea, which is what the analysts say, then that can't be anything short of the Pentagon planning for some type of nuclear armed exchange. That's what that X-band early warning radar system is about. So I had to go back and look to see what exactly John Kerry and Chuck Hagel worked out with their Japanese counterparts this week. This is actually just yesterday that this news was released. And Obama called it a rebalancing of U.S. military forces in the U.S. Indo-Pacific region, which of course means American hegemony there. And there's a whole shift that's going on that seems to be underreported here. Obama's moving 60% of American naval and air force assets to that region by the year 2020. And in part of his agreement with Japan, and I'm going to move on to a couple of other nations in a second, but part of that agreement is his putting P-8 surveillance and anti-submarine planes in Japan by the end of next year. And also two squadrons of the Osprey vertical takeoff planes that you see videos of on TV. And the Pentagon also plans to do other stealth fighting planes to Japan for the first time outside the United States in Japan. So these talks that Kerry is engaging in with the Japanese officials, and now that you've got a right-wing prime minister there, Shinzo Abe, who together they are seeking to overturn the Japanese constitution to allow it to do what John Kerry called collective self-defense. In other words, to engage in preemptive strikes against other countries. So, and Abiy was right on board with that. So they're coming out of this with a new angle or a new pivot to Asia, which is American imperialism in Japan, of all places. Let's change the constitution that we changed in Japan after World War II, and let's get ready for more. And I'll stop for just a second, but there's other visits that Hagel and Kerry made to South Korea and India, and that we can talk about that too.
Bob, if I remember right, I think it was General Douglas MacArthur who became the de facto boss of Japan after World War II, and I believe that he, under his aegis, the Japanese Constitution was rewritten to essentially ban the idea of Japanese militarism. And you're absolutely right. I mean, Obama's so-called Asia pivot to literally make the Asian continent a more important a strategic area for America than the Middle East. The Middle East is important, of course, because of all the oil and gas as well. So America wants its hands on that. But Asia is important because of China and Russia. Russia, the great military power. China, no military pushover by any means. Both those countries have nuclear arsenals, and they are both powerful. But China is an economic juggernaut. And in a number of years ahead, China is going to catch the U.S., and before too long after that, it'll become the world's number one economic power, and America can barely contain itself about the idea of that. And yet the nations are intertwined economically so closely that it's hard imagining either nation wants conflict with the other. Certainly business interests don't want this, but you've got this maniac Abe, and you've got Obama, who I like to say just can't wait to start another war. And for years, beginning under the Bush administration, I believe, Bob, America installing so-called missile defense, which has got nothing to do with defense, in countries encircling Russia and China, plus U.S. military bases encircling Russia and China, and both countries are furious about this stuff. And America won't even discuss it when U.S. officials go to the region. So you can see, I mean, thankfully we have a leader like Vladimir Putin in Russia who simply isn't going to put up with this stuff. And he comes out and makes very, very bold statements that need to be made. But Japan is just the opposite, Bob. And here you've got a country that was conquered by America and became a U.S. colony in 1945, August. I remember that time so well. The war ended just around the time of my birthday. I remember, Bob, hoping that the official signing of the end of war, the armistice, or whatever the precise document was they signed, I was hoping it would fall on my birthday, and I missed by a day or two.
What a shame about that.
Well, it was a shame, but the only other point I wanted to make was that after all these years, 1945 to 13 years, almost 13 years through the new millennium, Japan still lets America dominate it like a colony. What on earth is in the minds of the Japanese leaders and the Japanese people? Why on earth do they put up with this stuff?
Boy, that's a really good question, and you can ask that question domestically here. Why do the United States citizens put up with all that they do? And the Japanese, Japan's a smaller nation, and the citizens are very well informed from what I have been able to gather. So why they aren't saying something, it's really beyond me. South Korea is the exact template that Japan is, too, because what Kerry and Chuck Hagel did in South Korea just a couple of days before they were in Japan was exactly the same thing. And then I'm backtracking rather than going forward, but they went from South Korea to Japan. But before that, they were in the Philippines, and they signed another military agreement with the Philippines, allowing the United States to build a new military base there. So these are all the way around, and everybody is being very quiet about it. Right now, we've got something like 28,000 troops or something in South Korea. It's very unpopular with the South Koreans, and they're not the South Korean populace. And they're not hesitant to talk about that, about how unpopular that is. But it only reaches a certain point, and then it stops. And the same thing with India, backtracking Hagel and Kerry's trip even further. They come out with probably the most militaristic joint communique this week, or this past week. Prime Minister Manmohan Singh, they gave a complete communique regarding strategic military ties. And so even though we have a long history of India, of having these tensions with India because of the Cold War, the United States wanted to use India for its Cold War strategy, and India didn't want that. But now you've got India signing off with the United States, and the United States giving a pledge to help build India's new navy. They want to be a naval power. So here's the Obama administration coming over there in the person of John Kerry signing off on a United States commitment for our taxpayer dollars to build India's navy, of course, targeted at China. And they've already bragged in a fact sheet that the White House released after Kerry left India that we've already gotten $9 billion worth of military contracts to India, and it goes on and on from there. So you're going to get more and more military connections between the United States and India. And I can't help but think that that's not playing very well in Pakistan. I haven't heard anything specifically, but we all know the problems between India and Pakistan, but they're not going to be very happy about that, and China's going to be even less happy about that. But here comes the United States, and now we're militarizing India, the Philippines, South Korea, and Japan. And I don't see a whole lot of reporting going on about it, but it's a very serious turn that Obama's taking here, and he's moving all of our naval forces over there, the majority of them over there. So we better keep an eye on this. The people don't like it in any of those countries. Americans don't like it, but they're doing it. So where do we go with that?
Oh, I agree so much, Bob. And when it comes to people absolutely despising America's president, you mentioned the Philippines. The Philippines, some years back, kicked America out of two big bases that America had. Oh, that goes back, I forget the chronology exactly, at least back to the 1990s, maybe the 1980s, but it's been a good long time. Huge bases that America had. One of them was an air base, I believe. I guess the other one an army base. And America has been out of the Philippines formally. Not really, Bob, because U.S. forces have always have worked with the Filipino military and so on, doing it more on an informal basis. But now America is going to come back and be a formal presence. So the Filipinos hate us. The South Koreans absolutely hate us. We've been there since 1945. And the Japanese hate us, and they especially hate us on Okinawa, which is the southernmost prefecture of Japan. It's thought of as Japan's Puerto Rico, you know, a dumping ground. So literally, I mean, America doesn't care about the Puerto Ricans, although Puerto Rico is not a U.S. state, but Fukushima. Okinawa very definitely is part of Japan. It's as much part of Japan as California and Illinois are part of the United States. But the Okinawans, absolutely, they've lived with Americans for years, and the choicest real estate on Okinawa is occupied by U.S. bases, and thousands of U.S. troops are there, Air Force, Marines, Army, whatever they are, and they go wild, these young kids. They're on the loose. They commit crimes. They rape women. They commit robberies. They do all kinds of offensive things, and you can see why the Okinawans hate us. The military creates immense pollution, the kind of pollution we think about, as well as terrible noise pollution round the clock because the jets are taking off and flying around the clock all the time, and Okinawans have to live with this, and they absolutely want Americans out from their island. They want to be free again. And the Japanese government is doing nothing to help them. Just imagine, Bob, if you and I had to live with these roaring jets literally not that far above our heads, keeping us awake all night and everything else, plus polluting the ground and raping our women and doing the rest of it. This is what the Japanese have lived with since 1945.
Well, they're going to continue because one of the things that I neglected to mention about the joint communique, the agreements that came from the Obama administration and Abe administration, is that they reaffirmed their agreement that the U.S. military bases in Okinawa would stay open and that we would continue to put troops there. And actually, Japan even went further. They agreed to pay just something over $3 billion toward the relocation of 9,000 U.S. Marines to Guam as part of their commitment to the United States to help secure the Asian region from China, ostensibly. But they agreed. So here's the government, in direct opposition to the people, saying, well, we're going to keep the United States military there, even though everything that you said is true and everybody knows that it's true. That's what we're doing. And how is this going to impact 20 years down the road? Unless there's a nuclear war that kills everybody off, you know, you could see where the roadmap leaves everything. Just this week, I think it was, the UN came out with a report saying, okay, well, we can show you what happens when this goes on like this. And you may have read this, but they did a report on the U.S.-NATO war in Libya. And they said, here's the results of the NATO invasion and NATO attacks on these countries. We've got a firsthand map of it. It's called, the report's called Torture and Deaths in Detention in Libya. And they record specifically 27 cases that detainees have been tortured to death. And they know that there are at least 11 other cases that they couldn't get to for reasons I'll mention in a moment. But they're all taking place in detention centers where the government is allegedly under control, but not really. They're not really under control. There are networks of armed brigades that are in control of these centers, and nobody controls them. There are at least 8,000 citizens in these detention centers that we know of. There are many others who have been disappeared, starting to sound familiar, under no control of the government. They're grabbed from the streets. They're taken from their homes. They're not given any charges. They're just taken off. Their families don't know where they are. And those are just the areas that the UN inspectors were able to look at. There are many others that they couldn't get to, and they said in their report they weren't even able to get to the eastern part of Libya because throughout Libya, but particularly in the east, these armed little rebel groups are controlling the state. They include detention, interrogation, and they're growing. These armed groups are growing. So these jails and the brutalization that comes from the torture and the death and the disappearances, that's a regular thing in Libya. And that comes as a result of NATO, the United States, invading, attacking, destroying the infrastructure, governmental as well as the economic infrastructure, and then leaving it. And that's exactly what we're going to be seeing as this starts winding its way out over in the Asian Pacific as well. So the UN report said as much. Here's what happens when NATO attacks and then leaves it. So we've got a report now that shows it.
This report, Bob, is this a UN report?
It's a UN report, yeah.
It's a new one?
It's a brand new one. It just came out October 5th, I believe. And it's called Torture and Deaths in Detention in Libya.
Torture
and deaths in detention in Libya.
Oh, in detention. I was Googling it to try to find it. N-D-E-T-E-N-S-I-O-N in Libya. I'd like to see that report.
I can send you the report.
Oh, send me the report. Send me the report. I really would appreciate looking at it.
It came out October 3rd, not the 5th. I was reading it wrong. It's October 3rd.
Well, Libya, America's legacy in Libya, Bob. Same in Iraq, same in Afghanistan. These countries are literally cauldrons of violence. I mean, multiple car bombs explode on a daily basis in Iraq, and in a given month, hundreds of people are killed. I think in September it was over 1,000. I think in August it might have been over 1,000 as well. I mean, literally, Baghdad is a prime target, but they can go off anywhere in the country. This is America's legacy, and the occupation still continues because America has super bases in Iraq. And when Obama went through that fake drawdown and leaving Iraq, sure, there was a military drawdown. The troops were redeployed to other parts of the region, to Afghanistan, and this is what an American drawdown looks like. But American forces are very much still there. They're on these super-sized bases that are like small cities. I mean, literally, if you woke up and found yourself on one of these bases, whether they're in Afghanistan or Iraq or wherever else these places exist overseas, you would think you were in a U.S. city. They're no different. The same kind of amenities, the same stuff goes on. In Iraq, again, a cauldron of violence. Libya, completely out of control country. There's no government in Libya. You've got militias running things. You've got gangs fighting each other, challenging each other for power. They hold regional control. They can go around and kill anybody they want. This is a legacy in Libya. And Libya was Africa's most developed country. Libyans really had it good. Iraqis really had a good, except for the terrible government, the oppression from Saddam Hussein. But if you didn't challenge the regime, you got along just fine. And you also got free education, free health care, and you could live a very normal life in Iraq under Saddam Hussein. And it was much better under Gaddafi in Libya, where his government really, he gave Libya, a smaller country, about 6 million people, and he used the nation's oil wealth responsibly, which happened in Iraq as well. And Libyans had free education, free health care. I remember seeing a video, Bob, of Gaddafi going down a main street in Tripoli in an open car, and there were people lined up along the sides of the road cheering him, and it looked for real to me. And the fact that he was in an open car, I mean, anybody could have taken a pot shot at him, but it didn't happen. And again, I thought the people really, really were cheering him legitimately because they appreciated all the benefits they got. They lived normal lives, and they had great amenities, including giving a huge stipend, thousands of dollars, to newlyweds in Libya. There was no homelessness in Libya.
That's why we had to attack them, Stephen, and Iraq the same way. The oil, of course, is a big, huge issue in the natural gas. But the other dynamic to that is a dynamic that plays out in Syria, too, and that is if you have a stable and prosperous society that is growing, that even if you have a tyrant there but the society is growing, that's too unified a society and too much of a threat to United States hegemony and imperialism, and that's got to be overthrown. So we do it in Iraq, and then we do it in Libya, and we're about to try to do it in Syria, too. But I hear the music. We can come back.
Oh, indeed, boss. The music is playing. We need to take a break. We'll do that shortly, and we'll come right back. Robert Everly. Bob, there's just so many issues we can talk about. Can I mention one, and then we can go back to what we were talking about at break time? I just literally got an email from a woman down in Texas, and I'll just very briefly read a couple of things that she said. I have been under surveillance by people posing as the FBI, Texas Rangers, Sheriff's Office, and other local authorities for almost 3 years. Let me state I have no criminal record. They are using technology to invade my entire life, from my home to my car to my workplace, everywhere I have traveled to other states, and they are there as well. I am talked to at all times, but I can only believe to be low-frequency transmissions. And then she goes on to say things that she's hearing. And other people say the same thing. I wrote twice about this kind of thing, Bob. It's been a while. 2010, I just checked, as a matter of fact, because I got an email from a psychiatrist in Nigeria this morning asking me about this. He wanted some information on how he could help some of his patients who apparently come to him with this kind of situation. But I have never written articles, only two of them, and it's been a couple of years since I wrote the second one, where from those years, from 2010 to this morning and this afternoon, I keep getting emails from people who ask me questions about this, and the main thing they want to know is, how can I get help? And some of them ask me, is it in my head or is it real? And I assure everybody that it's not in their head. This is very, very real. But it shows another way the U.S. operates, Bob, where they can go at people in terms of waging foreign wars. They can target, they can kill people in America if they want to. I mean, just shoot them, get rid of them, abduct them, throw them in a dungeon, do anything they want with them, and they can bombard them with these low-frequency transmissions, maybe intended to drive them nuts. What kind of a country does stuff like this, Bob? It certainly isn't a normal one.
That's news to me. I've never heard that before. I thought I was really up to date when I was reading about the NSA's spying with their social networks diagrams that they've been doing that came out from the New York Times a week or two ago. I've never heard of that, what you're talking about. I thought that the metadata logs that Edward Snowden revealed were kind of the top of the heap of everything so far. I didn't know that they were doing low frequency transmissions. I've never heard of that before.
I think there were a number of programs, Bob, and they really go back. I don't know when they began, but they at least go back to the 1940s, and the CIA was involved in them. CIA had a program called Ultra. But the U.S. Navy, it's been so long since I wrote these articles, I'd have to go back and refresh my memory. But I know the Navy had something. The CIA had a number of programs. One of them was called, I think it was a longer name than Ultra, but the name Ultra was in it. And I think different U.S. agencies had programs like this. But from that time to the present, I mean, the stuff has gotten so sophisticated over the years, and I know the CIA experimented with illicit drugs, from LSD to other drugs, and literally drove people insane with the kind of stuff they did to them, and they didn't know what was being done to them, but their minds were being manipulated, and these were CIA experiments with professionals involved running them. This and all this other stuff going on, including these low frequency transmissions to people. Maybe they're experimenting. Maybe they want to see what kind of harm can they do. What can they use? What can they do with these technologies in terms of military operations? But again, I say, what kind of a country does stuff like this? Does it to its own people at home? So much more as well, where literally toxins have been released in U.S. cities. I absolutely remember writing about that. Biological agents released in the New York subway, in San Francisco, in a number of other U.S. cities. And, of course, in every war that America wages, Bob, banned weapons are used. Chemical weapons, radiological weapons, biological weapons, in every American war and in every Israeli war, and that is an absolute fact, and there's hard evidence to prove it.
Well, there's plenty of evidence to prove it. There's you can start with the cluster munitions that the Tomahawk missiles. Every time you hear the word Tomahawk missiles, it's connected with cluster munitions. So that's banned in international law. So when that comes out, and we're going to be using Tomahawk missiles against Syria or whatever, you know what's in it. And you know that it's a double standard that the United States is holding, that nobody else can do this but us. So, gosh, you could go on and on with that. The germ warfare, chemical warfare the United States has been engaged in since 1900, starting in the Philippines with beriberi and all the way up to contemporary times, the use of white phosphorus that we used in Fallujah, that Israelis use against Palestinians, including all the other things Israeli army uses against the Palestinians, all condemned by international law. It's all illegal, and yet it's being done. Assassinations, it was in the news this week that the head of Iran's cyberware program was assassinated by Israel. It was a Mossad operation, obviously illegal, but those are the things that go on, but it's only when others do it that it becomes illegal. It's when others do it, then we have to go to war over it. When we do it, well, it's okay. It's us. And that never comes out more clearly to me than when you take into account the Hague Invasion Act that makes U.S. personnel and allies immune from international law. So even Harry Truman was immune from international law when he dropped the two atomic bombs in Japan. So we don't have to subscribe to the international rule of law, but the rest of the world does. You're absolutely right.
Talk about a double standard, Bob. Absolutely. Israel and America rail about a non-existent Iranian nuclear program. Clear, hard evidence supplied by U.S. intelligence on an annual basis shows that Iran's nuclear program is absolutely peaceful. There's not a shred of evidence suggesting otherwise, but at the same time, America is the world's most formidable nuclear power. Israel has an arsenal of nuclear weapons, long-range delivery systems, formidable chemical and biological weapons, and Israel doesn't use nuclear bombs, not that I know of, but uses radiological weapons in its wars. Chris Busby again, Bob, the nuclear expert, I believe after Israel's 2006 Lebanon war, he discovered enriched uranium residue in Lebanon, I believe, and I think it's also in Gaza, showing that Israel uses radiological weapons aside from depleted uranium weapons, and depleted uranium is used in munitions ranging from bullets to bombs to artillery shells to cruise missiles to anything. But if you can imagine a bullet having a depleted uranium tip. And the reason, for those who don't remember or forgot, the reason depleted uranium is used is because it cuts through metal like a knife through butter. So the military loves this stuff, but it leaves radiation behind, and radiation kills.
Sure. And, you know, I came across this week the new book by Max Blumenthal, which you might have heard of, called Goliath.
Oh, I have heard of it, yes.
And he's got some interesting things that he talks about in there in that regard. What's going on with what Israel is doing and the complete right-wing growth in Israel, and the ethnic cleansing of the Bedouins that are there, and the oppression of the Palestinians. They use chemical weapons in part to do it. And we know this. I mean, this has been traced out in study after study, that since 2001 at least, with the outbreak of the Second Intifada, there's numerous incidents of Israel using what is simply classified as an unknown gas against the Palestinians. But the doctors who have examined them have said this is not the normal tear gas. This is something else, because these people's lungs are really badly burned, and there's canisters that were left over which are clearly not tear gas. And that was documented in the movie Gaza Strip, and I can't remember who did that, but he just happened to be there at the time, and so he started showing these canisters and interviewing these doctors who were saying they're using some type of chemical here that it's not normal gas. So BBC television went to the Israeli government, to officials in the Israeli government. They kept getting the same line, refusal to answer. Israel would not say what the new gas is. That was from 2001 to 2004. Now we know that after the Gaza assault in 2006, that there were numerous victims, dozens upon dozens, that had completely burned bodies and shrapnel-type injuries that had occurred that X-ray machines couldn't detect. So there's something else that they were using, that it's some type of inert metal explosive is what they're calling it. And then there's other carcinogenic substances that are in these people's bodies. So, and of course, we just talked about the phosphorus. So, yeah, Israel does it. The United States does it. It's only bad when somebody else that we don't like does it. But we do it all the time. And Israel just simply has refused to sign the 1972 Biological Weapons Convention. It's refused to sign the 1993 Chemical Weapons Convention. Just doesn't sign it, and then goes ahead and uses the chemical weapons that it wants. And those are ours, too, by the way, our money. They've got their own, according to Max Blumenthal, they've got their own, both their own ability to process uranium and their ability to create their own chemical weapons there. But we're buying it for them, so we're directly involved in that. So we got to take a look at that.
Oh, it's so true, Bob. Also, the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, Israel never signed that. And, of course, Israel is a nuclear power. And Iran was one of the first nations to sign NPT back in the 1960s. Might have been 1968. And Israel, after all these years, Israel began developing nuclear weapons in the 1950s. David Ben-Gurion wanted them. He wanted chemical and biological weapons. And he enlisted scientists that he had come to Israel. So Israel's WMD program goes back to the 1950s. And it never stopped, and America is very definitely involved in it. Our tax dollars go to supporting this kind of stuff, killing all sorts of people, and many of them don't die from injuries from these weapons. They die from the toxic fallout from these weapons. Just horrendous, Bob. And again, nobody talks about it. Nobody says anything about it. The double standard persists. It's really a wretched situation. Oh, one more thing. After the December 2008, January 2009, gas lead war on Gaza, a three-week war on Gaza. I had a Norwegian doctor on my program, Bob, and I can't recall his name. I know I wrote about him, and I could find it by digging back into my files. But a Norwegian doctor who did volunteer medical work in Gaza after that war, and he wrote a book about it. That's the reason I had him on. I had him on to discuss his book. And he and other medical professionals said they saw injuries in Gaza they never saw before, and they could only determine that they came from weapons that they never heard of, that they knew nothing about. And again, these injuries, all sorts of injuries, and I'd have to go back and refresh my memory on them, but some of them could have been, white phosphorus, of course. White phosphorus burns flesh to the bone, but I think there were other injuries where maybe internal organs were damaged, but there was no surface evidence that something penetrated to do it. But all kinds of weapons that Israel has and uses them illegally, and they test new weapons that should be banned when they fight their wars or their mini-wars, and this is the kind of stuff that goes on. But when professionals, doctors, experienced people see injuries, they've seen many injuries in the past, but they've never seen anything like they see when they go to Gaza or they go to South Lebanon to see what Israel did there. And this is what Israel does, and America does exactly the same thing. And again, our tax dollars, Bob, go to supply Israel with these weapons of mass destruction.
Sure. That kind of dovetails into what I was going to mention a second ago, and that was if you listen to the speech that Netanyahu gave at the UN, and by my count, actually, Max Blumenthal said the same thing in interviews. He mentioned Iran at least 50 times, at least. He mentioned the Palestinians maybe 5 times. So he just wants to gloss over the fact that what you and I are talking about here, the thousands of illegal arrests of Palestinians, the detentions in detention centers, the torture that goes on there, just like the United States engages in, the 2,000 new settlements that Netanyahu has authorized, his authorizing another $360 million to build more walls and mine more fields, and at the same time cutting $360 million from social spending to do it. All of this is going on right under our noses, but we can't really see it because nobody's talking about it. And all the public face that the Americans get to see is Netanyahu standing at that podium at the UN saying, Iran's bad, we got to get Iran, Iran can't do this. And he's doing far worse than anything Iran does. And by the time the truth catches up to that, people are already on to another, the next topic right away. So this is a really serious issue, that there's a double standard, and Israel is the center of that double standard in the Middle East, and they're the most powerful nation there, thanks to us. So it's, again, this do as we tell you to do, don't do as we do, and that's the problem. So if Obama was really serious about peace, he would just say, okay, we should everybody start following international law. But that's never happened in the United States, never is going to happen in the United States. I mean, you look back just in the last 40 years, what the United States has done with other countries. Chile, overthrowing a democratically elected government, imposing a brutal dictatorship there. Iran, in the 1950s, Guatemala, Indochina, Central America, on and on we go. So it's again that double standard that I think at some point has to come back and bite us at some level. And we may see that a little bit with Syria, because it's been about 10 days now, but I remember reading in the New York Times that the U.S.-backed Free Syrian Army joined publicly with al-Qaeda 10 days ago and issued a public statement. And they even said in their statement that all groups, I wrote this down so I'm going to read it to you, all groups formed abroad without having returned to the country do not represent us. So in other words, we're taking the arms and munitions and the financial support of the United States, but you, United States, you don't belong to us. We're going to do what we want, and we're in now with al-Qaeda. And the first of 13 groups that signed this was the al-Nusra Front, the one that Washington also has declared a terrorist organization. So now you've got al-Qaeda, the U.S. government calls terrorists, the al-Nusra Front, the United States calls terrorists, and the Free Syrian Army that the United States calls freedom fighters, and now they're all working together, taking arms and munitions from the United States and then giving us the finger in return, saying, you don't belong to us because you're from outside the country. That's something that we could, there's a little blowback in the process there, but it may end up doing exactly what the U.S. wants, and that is maintain the pressure on Assad, divide Syria, make sure it can't be a Mideastern power, leave Israel as the only standing Mideastern power, which is really kind of our colony and vice versa, break down all these other Arab democracies and any other Arab rising that comes up and use it to your advantage while talking about how evil the others are.
Again, so true, Bob. I noticed an article written by a rabbi, among other things in the article. I was concerned with other things that he said, but one, and I didn't address the comment I'll make now, where he said, there is no possibility, zero chance of America going to war with Syria. And I don't know where this rabbi gets his information, but I would say that the chance of America going to war with Syria is no less now than it was a month ago or 2 months ago or a year ago. The American campaign to topple the Syrian government began years ago before Obama was president. It goes back, I think, to the 1990s, but it certainly goes back to the Bush administration. And these things have been ongoing ever since. And it's a very simple, same thing with Iran, to topple the Iranian government. That goes back 35 years, almost 35 years. The 35th anniversary next February, a little bit after that, there was a short period of time after the new government came in, even though there was great U.S. anger about the takeover over the U.S. embassy, but the real story about that was never told. I mean, America was a rogue state causing so much trouble with Iran, and things changed dramatically after that 79 revolution. But the real key point is that America tolerates no independent sovereign countries. They want all pro-Western ones in the world, literally everywhere. So the countries that are being targeted for regime change include Syria. Well, we've seen Iraq. We saw Afghanistan. We saw Libya. We see Syria. We see Iran. We see Venezuela. And a number of them have similar things about them. One of them is especially Syria, Iran, Libya, Venezuela. They have independent central banks. They're not part of the Federal Reserve System. This is it. This is the worst no-no. So the first thing that was done when America took over Libya was to get rid of the Libyan banking system and install a Western banking system. And that's exactly what the big thing ruining the country. And the same thing went on in Iraq, and wherever America shows up. But they want these governments toppled to get a complete Western regime installed. And the independence of these countries simply isn't tolerated. And I would say that the chance of a war against Syria is closer to 100% than to 0%, and it could happen a number of different ways. There's certainly a hiatus temporarily using what I call cruise missile diplomacy against the Syrian government, but I expect that to get cranked up again. We had a false flag chemical attack in a Damascus suburb that I wrote so much about, this suburb called Ghouta, where the insurgents absolutely were the ones that pulled it off. Saudi Arabia was behind the whole thing. They supplied the weapons, they supplied the money, they supplied everything going on, and they did it before. And there have been many chemical attacks in Syria, all done by these insurgents, and never one time has a Syrian government had anything to do with it. And the hard evidence proves it. Russia has the evidence, Syria sure has the evidence, and the UN has the evidence. But they say one thing, they do another. There was a UN report earlier where a head of a small commission, Khalid Del Ponte, said that the Syrian government had nothing to do with a specific chemical weapons attack, but the Syrian rebels, she called them, they're not rebels, they're invaders. They're death squads. They're the ones who did it, and he was a UN agency saying that, and that certainly is true about all the other attacks. But you hear the bald-faced lies, Bob, one after another. But I absolutely think there's a war coming against Syria. There's a war going on right now, but I expect America to be absolutely involved full-time, and it could be the next false flag that comes. That's what I expect. I expect another big chemical attack or another false flag of another kind, and America will falsely blame it on the Syrian government, and bingo, we're right back in the same thing again. So the idea that the coast is clear, that's absolutely false.
No, I totally agree. I don't think that, I think the title of the article that you wrote was The War Has Been Delayed or Postponed, not
yes.
Put off or something. And I've got the same idea as you, and I've got a bit of a different angle on that. And it comes from what I read about Obama doing with trying to push Russia and China with regard to this. Syria has met the first of its deadlines about handing over the details of its chemical weapons stockpiles to the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons in The Hague. They did do that. And I didn't think they were going to be able to pull that off, and I thought Obama was going to use that. But once that happened, that Syria was able to do that, Obama's next move was to push Russia and China into agreeing that he, President Obama, could use Chapter 7 of the UN Charter that allows for military force to impose penalties on other countries who are not complying with international agreements. That's the same thing that we used to get into Libya, that Obama used Chapter 7 of the UN Charter for its own purposes to establish no-fly zones in Libya. That's how it all starts, just like it did in Iraq. We'll start with no-fly zones, and that allowed us to come in and attack. So now Obama's pressing China and Russia to allow this, and so far Russia's been adamant about this because they know exactly what Obama's got in mind. That they've seen it already. We've seen it already. They did it in Libya. So Russia so far has been holding steadfast, saying, no, this is not going to be used. The Chapter 7 is not going to be used. We're going to do it exactly like we agreed to. But Obama's saying, well, I don't want to go by that agreement anymore. I want to use Chapter 7. And John Kerry, I'm directing to do that. And so this is where I think that's going to come in. I don't even know if they need a false flag. All they have to do is Obama has to make the decree. Syria missed a deadline. We're going in. And Chapter 7 kicks in at the emperor's will, and then he can set up the no-fly zone and take it from there. That's how I think it's going to happen. It could be a false flag, but I think it's going to be probably something a little less than that, because the false flag didn't work. And now they've tried two false flags, and they didn't work. So they're going to have to try some other bureaucratic maneuver, and I think that's going to be it. We're going to use Chapter 7. We're going to set up no-fly zones. We're going to enforce them, and next thing you know, it's going to be an all-out attack. That's my guess.
Bob, but you raise a very important point, and I think that's very possible. I wrote about the UN resolution, Security Council Resolution 2118. Anybody can look it up on the UN site and read the resolution. Chapter 7 is mentioned at the end, but the resolution is worded in a way, as I understand it, that the only way Chapter 7 could be invoked is you've got to go back to the Security Council and have a supplemental resolution authorizing specific action under Chapter 7 based on provable evidence that Syria broke the terms of its agreement. That's my understanding. But, you know, America can twist things any way it wants, so Obama that can be the language, and Obama can end up doing what he wants anyway. That's my fear.
That's probably right. That's what I'm trying to get at. I think it's going to be a bureaucratic maneuver like that, and it'll be the PR blanket that Obama needs to start the war.
It could very well be, Bob. The music means we're out of time. It was another great hour. They go so fast.
They do.
So fast.
We just start talking, and then we have to stop.
Oh, indeed. But at least we made it through with no technical glitches, so I'm very grateful for that. I thank my studio host for keeping me on air. Bob, again, many, many thanks.
You're welcome, Stephen. I look forward to talking to you.
Oh, I look forward to more. I'll shoot you an email off air. Join us every Friday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. And barring the showing up of the gremlins, we will be with you live. Make it a regular habit.